Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 189. It's Monday, December 5th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, let's start with seasonal news. It's infectious respiratory disease season, otherwise known as flu season. This from Caitlin Rivers on Substack, an epidemiologist. High or very high levels of flu activity across the nation. Any hope that flu season was slowing down evaporated with this week's update. In other words, this flu season is shaping up to be a big one. Last week, 1 in 13 visits to the doctor were for influenza-like illness, the highest it's been in years and a large increase compared to prior weeks. Influenza-like illnesses include both influenza and other infections that cause fever and cough or sore throat, but not likely COVID-19. All age groups showed a significant rise, with notable acceleration in preschool and school-age children. Among 0 to 4-year-olds, 1 in 6 visits to the doctor were for influenza-like illnesses. This has been a very rough winter already for children, with overwhelmed pediatric hospitals, school outbreaks, and shortages of over-the-counter medications. It looks like us parents are still in the thick of it. The U.S. influenza transmission map is dramatic. The whole country is experiencing high or very high levels of activity. And yes, Ohio, we have peaked out. There's about 14 categories. We are in the highest category of flu. Unfortunately, severe disease is following. Nearly 20,000 new admissions occurred last week for flu, which is almost double the prior week. Hospitalization rates are highest in people in young children and older adults. Unfortunately, COVID-19 is taking a turn for the worse as well. The number of new hospitalizations is spiking, especially in people age 70 plus. Test positivity is also surging, another troubling indicator that we're headed into a new wave. It is not too late to get your vaccinations if you haven't already. It looks like the flu shot will be a good match this year. We are also wearing high-quality masks indoors. If you're sick, please stay home. More holidays and parties and travel are coming up, and we want everyone to be as healthy as possible. Okay, well, let's drill down a little bit on the COVID situation. This from the Washington Post. COVID hospitalizations rising post-Thanksgiving after an autumn lull. A post-Thanksgiving uptake in COVID-19 patients at U.S. hospitals is arriving, even as health systems contend with waves of feverish coughing people stricken with RSV and influenza infections. COVID hospitalizations last week reached their highest level in 3 months, with more than 35,000 patients being treated. National hospitalizations had stagnated throughout fall, but started rising in the days leading up to Thanksgiving. All but a few states reported per capita increases in the past week. Public health authorities are concerned that the increase in the number of COVID patients will worsen the strain on hospitals already under pressure from the effects of two other viral ailments, influenza and respiratory syncytial virus, widely known as RSV. Daily new COVID hospital admissions are now above 9,000 after hovering between 5,000 and 7,000 for much of the autumn. Experts say the trend drives home the importance of people 65 and older receiving updated booster shots tailored to the Omicron variant. Less than a third of that age cohort has received the latest shot, according to the CDC. And if you think that you've actually dodged COVID, one of those few people, it's a good chance you may be wrong. This from Mercury News. Just 1 in 20 people in the U.S. have dodged COVID infection so far, study says. an estimated 94% of people in the U.S. have been infected with the COVID-19 virus at least once, according to a new paper from researchers at Harvard School of Public Health. Between December 1, 2021 and November 9, 2022, protection against a new Omicron infection rose from 22 to 63% nationally. And protection against an Omicron infection leading to severe disease increased from 61% to 89%, the analysis found. So I want to break that down a little bit, because a lot of times these numbers make more sense if you actually do the inverse of it. So the protection against a new Omicron infection was 22% at the end of last year and recently has bumped up to 63%. So that means your vulnerability decreased from 78% down to 27%. So that's good news. And then protection against Omicron leading to severe disease increased from 61% to 89%. If you do the inverse of that, that means moving from a 39% vulnerability down to 11%. So very large increase. The numbers actually look bigger, and it's a better way to understand it, I think. Although it's the same numbers, just a different way to look at it. The authors warn that despite the high level of protection at the beginning of the 2022-2023 winter, risk of reinfection and subsequent severe disease remains present. And they caution that the introduction of a more transmissible or immune-evading variant, changes in human behavior, and ongoing waning of immunity could change the calculations. The study estimated that in less than a year, there were 116 million first infections in the country and 209 million reinfections, nearly all from Omicron subvariants. Even with high levels of immunity, COVID continues to be a killer virus. We still have an unbelievable amount of deaths per day in the U.S., even more remarkable given this is a lull. And the CDC's publication, the MMWR, showed that 44% of adults reporting having had no COVID infection actually have serologic evidence of infection. So people that had blood evidence that they were infected actually did not even realize that they had infection, which is consistent with the fact that a lot of infections are asymptomatic. And this next story is an interesting one, talking about the relative impact of older versus younger people, looking back for at the first and second years of the pandemic. This from The Hill. Young people accounted for a greater proportion of COVID-19 deaths in 2021 than in 2020. So this is interesting. After we got vaccinations, it closed that gap and means that younger people had a larger proportion of deaths. So a shift in COVID-19 mortality to relatively younger people in the second pandemic year contributed to markedly increased premature mortality from this increasingly preventable death. The median age of COVID-19 deaths fell from 78 years old in 2020 to 69 years old in 2021. To understand the downward age shifts in deaths, researchers calculated years of life lost as opposed to simple mortality from March through December 2020, as well as for the same time frame in 2021. By calculating years of life lost, investigators were able to assess premature deaths based on the estimated number of years a person would have lived if they had not died prematurely. Although there were around 21% fewer deaths in 2021 than 2020, years of life lost from COVID-19 actually rose by 7.4%. while years of life lost per COVID death increased by 36%. So it was killing less people, but the people that were dying were much younger, so you actually had more years of potential life lost. Another way to look at it and to see the disproportionate impact when younger people are killed by COVID. Got to look out for that too, young folks. If you're eligible for a booster, go ahead and get it. It's a very cost-effective and effective at preventing severe disease. Okay, well, next up, I want to switch to a more global view of COVID in the here and now. And this is from Caitlin Gentilina, your local epidemiologist. COVID-19 in China and global concern. After Omicron emerged as a highly contagious variant of concern, the majority of the world accepted a harm reduction strategy. Get vaccine in as many arms as possible, then slowly open up. In many countries, this turned out to be a good public health strategy to reduce death, minimize stress on healthcare systems, improve quality of life, improve the economy, etc. However, China continues to attempt a zero COVID strategy, very, very tight restrictions in an attempt to stop all transmission. While China's strategy has an upside, like massively reduced deaths, reduced long COVID rates, and decreased chances of mutations, it has massive downsides. It's clear that the ever stricter measures fail to keep up with the more transmissible variants while becoming increasingly costly to society. This has caused countrywide protests sparked by frustration, anger, discontent, and despair. COVID-19 seems to be on the verge of exploding in China. They are reporting record high numbers, nearly 40,000 new infections per day. That's a lot less than we're doing. We're doing a lot less testing. The biggest concern is China's incomplete immunity wall when faced with infections. First, China does have a highly vaccinated population. About 90% are vaccinated with the primary series. This is higher than the United States. However, quality, not just quantity, the vaccine is important. China rolled out Sinopharm and Sinovac, inactivated vaccines that are just not very effective against Omicron. Two, their booster rate, and specifically who is boosted, is abysmal. Only 30% of 80-plus-year-olds have one booster, for example. We have plenty of evidence showing the importance of boosters among the most vulnerable. Third, infection-induced immunity is low. While preventing infections is the safest route, we have more than 30 studies showing hybrid immunity, that is, people that have both vaccine and infection, builds a more complex immunity wall for the virus. So what's the impact? Last winter, we witnessed what Omicron could do in a population with an incomplete immunity wall. Death rates in Hong Kong went vertical. It was simply disastrous. What could happen across all of China? A scientific publication in Nature Medicine predicted a grim picture earlier this year. They ran a number of models with varied infection rates, booster rates, vaccine efficacy, and the use of non-pharmaceutical interventions like masks and social distancing and more. In conclusion, over a six-month period, China would experience 112 million symptomatic cases, 2.7 million ICU admissions, which would exceed their ICU capacity by almost 16 times, and over 1.5 million deaths, 75% of them among those age 60 and older. So what's the solution? From a public health perspective, I'm not sure how this ends well for China, as there are very few ways out of this scenario. The best option is to vaccinate as many people as possible, especially older adults, through a very intense, massive public health campaign. They are starting to do this, but too late, and ideally, they would use mRNA vaccines. China has about 10 mRNA vaccines in the development pipeline, but to my knowledge, none are close to a rollout. My hope is that they will pivot to American vaccines soon, but I'm not holding my breath. They could wait for second-generation vaccines that stop transmission, but this will take a lot of time. A vaccine campaign has challenges too, mainly lack of trust. A great article covered why China has not implemented a vaccine mandate, even though they implement other very strict measures. Dramatic social resistance. Japan has released scientific results of the first effective antiviral for non-high-risk people. I would pair this with Paxlovid, better ventilation, and masks, and hope for the best. In all, I think the situation in China is about more than public health. It's about politics, control, autonomy from the West, and so much more, which makes solving the public health problem that much more difficult. Global implications. We should be very concerned for the people of China, but this situation also has global implications. If the floodgates open, there will be an impact on the economy. We've seen throughout the pandemic that healthy people equals a healthy economy. A massive outbreak in China would have a global cascading impact on supply chains. It could also impact viral evolution. If COVID-19 takes hold in China, there would be little to stop the virus from jumping person to person in a network of 1.4 billion people, about 20% of the global population. Some mutations arise from persistent infection with immunocompromised people. We think this is how Omicron developed. But the more a virus jumps, the more opportunity it has to randomly mutate. This is how we got Delta, for example. To add fuel to the fire, global COVID-19 surveillance is down 90%. So if we do get a mutated virus, we won't have a lot of warning. In fact, we don't even know which Omicron subvariant is causing the current wave in China. With more than 500 subvariants circulating, we are seeing more second-generation subvariants than ever. They are popping up independently across the globe. This suggests that we may finally be seeing ladder-like evolution patterns, which would be good news, as we can finally start predicting where the virus may go, like the flu or other coronaviruses. Given the situation in China, I really hope we won't see Pi, the next variant of concern. but there's a possibility. The bottom line, China backed themselves into a grim corner, and all we can do is watch how this unfolds in the next few weeks. And as we've seen throughout the pandemic, what happens in one country can directly impact everyone else. Okay, well, next up, I want to do an update on the measles outbreak in Columbus. This from the Columbus Dispatch. Measles outbreak in Columbus increases to 50 cases, 4 sites exposed. The number of cases in a measles outbreak in Columbus has nearly doubled over the past 2 weeks, with exposures being reported in 4 places across the city, according to public health officials. There are 50 cases in Greater Columbus as of last Friday, according to the Columbus Public Health Dashboard, up from 24 cases reported earlier this month. Health Commissioner Dr. Myshika Roberts said during a news conference last Wednesday that the cases are spread out in 3 public health jurisdictions, Columbus Public Health, Franklin County Public Health, and Ross County Health District. The message is clear. If you have a child who is 12 months of age and older and has not received their MMR, that is the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, please make every effort you can to get them vaccinated this week, she said. Robert said about 25% of the population in the area is unvaccinated. About 1 in 5 people in the U.S. who get measles will be hospitalized, according to the CDC. The disease is also highly contagious, as around 90% of unvaccinated individuals who are exposed to measles will become infected. No matter what your age, if you're an adult not vaccinated, take the MMR vaccine. If you're a child and eligible to get vaccinated, get the MMR, Dr. Roberts said. And in more infectious disease news, this from the Washington Post, CDC expands wastewater testing for polio to Michigan and Pennsylvania. The CDC is expanding efforts to test wastewater to detect the polio virus in Philadelphia and the Detroit area, targeting communities at highest risk for the life-threatening and potentially disabling illness. The expansion of wastewater monitoring for polio comes amid pressure to increase efforts to fight the disease after the first U.S. polio case in nearly a decade was discovered in New York's Rockland County in July. Ever since the unvaccinated man was diagnosed, the virus has been detected in wastewater samples from nearby communities, New York City, Orange County, Sullivan County, and Nassau County on Long Island. The Michigan and Philadelphia Health Departments are working with the CDC to identify communities that are under-vaccinated for poliovirus and have wastewater sampling locations. Other state and local health departments are also talking to the CDC about potential wastewater testing. Polio, once one of the most feared diseases in the U.S., with annual outbreaks causing thousands of cases of paralysis, was considered to be eliminated in 1979 after widespread vaccination halted routine U.S. spread, but the virus has been brought into the country by travelers. One case of paralytic polio potentially indicates that there may be hundreds of other cases, most of whom experience only mild illness. Polio paralyzes about 1 out of every 200 people who contract the virus. There is no treatment other than supportive care. Once someone catches polio, it's too late to prevent dire complications of the virus. Despite the renewed threat, a survey released last Wednesday by the Annenberg Public Policy Center found that a sizable portion of Americans are unfamiliar with the risks of polio. Only 1/3 of U.S. adults know there is no cure for polio, and over 1 in 5 don't know whether they've been vaccinated against polio. Strains of poliovirus can be shed in people's stool without symptoms, putting unvaccinated people at risk. Finding the virus in sewage or wastewater indicates that someone in the community is shedding the virus. But wastewater data cannot be used to determine or identify who is infected or how many people or households are affected. When will we know that we're out of the woods? When we get our vaccine rates at the national level to 93 or 94% to have herd immunity in the community, referring to when enough individuals have been vaccinated so their collective immunity prevents the virus from circulating in that population. Michigan's Oakland County, the state's second most populous county and part of the Detroit metropolitan area, is the state's first location for the wastewater polio surveillance because of its low vaccination rates and because vaccine-preventable outbreaks have occurred in the past, said Joe Coyle, director of the Bureau of Infectious Disease Prevention at Michigan's Department of Health and Human Services. Although most Americans are protected against polio if they have been fully vaccinated, declining childhood vaccination rates in some pockets of the country and the increase in parents seeking childhood immunization waivers for school entry raises the risk of more vaccine-preventable diseases, Coyle said. Just under 80% of children in Oakland County have received 3 doses of the polio vaccine by the time they were 19 months old. A total of 4 shots are required for full immunity. The CDC recommends children get their first polio vaccination at 2 months with follow-up shots at 4 months, between 6 and 18 months, and between ages 4 and 6. In a few neighborhoods in South Philadelphia, fewer than 60% of children under 5 had received 4 doses of the vaccine, according to their health department. Since poliovirus is excreted in stool, monitoring wastewater can potentially find chains of transmission earlier, allowing actions to be taken to break the chains before anyone is paralyzed. And in some good news, on another infectious disease outbreak front, this from The Hill, Biden administration not expecting to renew monkeypox public health emergency. The Department of Health and Human Services said last Friday that it does not expect to renew the public health emergency declaration for the monkeypox outbreak when it expires early next year, citing the low number of cases that are now being reported. Given the low number of cases today, HHS does not expect that it needs to renew the emergency declaration when it ends on January 31st, but we won't take our foot off the gas. We will continue to monitor the case trends closely and encourage all at-risk individuals to get a free vaccine, said Secretary Xavier Becerra in a statement. HHS said that this decision was based on current data and added it would not be afraid to change course if conditions change in the future. According to the most recent federal data, the 7-day moving average for monkeypox cases is 7, a steep drop from the average peak, which peaked at about 460 cases in early August. Meanwhile, in Africa, this from Medical Express, African continent finally to receive first mpox vaccines. Africa's top public health body said the continent is set to receive its first batch of mpox vaccines as a donation from South Korea. And by the way, mpox is the new name for monkeypox. We'll get that in the next story. The Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said last Thursday the 50,000 doses will be used first for health workers and people living in the hardest hit areas. No timing was given for the dose's arrival. The continent this year has recorded 202 deaths from mpox, formerly known as monkeypox, with a fatality rate of over 19% across 13 countries. And yet, African health authorities for months have pursued vaccines mostly in vain, as major outbreaks were reported in rich Western countries for the first time. A tale as old as time. And in more progress on that front, this from Politico, the WHO to rename monkeypox as mpox. The World Health Organization is planning to rename monkeypox, designating it as mpox, in an effort to destigmatize a virus that gained a foothold in the U.S. earlier this year. Public health experts and LGBTQ activists had similarly called for abandoning the virus's name, which it received upon its discovery in 1958, since it began spreading widely this past spring. They argued that calling it the monkeypox is imprecise, plays into racist stereotypes about Africa, and is detrimental to the global response. In the context of the current global outbreak, continued reference to and nomenclature of this virus being African is not only inaccurate, but it's also discriminatory and stigmatizing, a group of scientists wrote in a joint statement published in June. And next up, even more infectious disease news, this also in a global context, this from Associated Press. WHO and CDC, a record 40 million kids miss measles vaccine dose. The World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say measles immunization has dropped significantly since the coronavirus pandemic began, resulting in a record high of nearly 40 million children missing a vaccine dose last year. In a report issued last Wednesday, the WHO and the CDC said millions of children are now susceptible to measles, among the world's most contagious diseases. In 2021, officials said there were about 9 million measles infections and 128,000 deaths worldwide. The WHO and CDC said continued drops in vaccination, weak disease surveillance, and delayed response plans due to COVID-19, in addition to outgoing outbreaks in more than 20 countries, means that measles is an imminent threat in every region of the world. Scientists estimate that at least 95% of the population needs to be immunized to protect against epidemics. The WHO and CDC reported that only about 81% of children receive their first dose of measles vaccine, while 71% get their second dose, marking the lowest global coverage rates of the first measles dose since 2008. More than 95% of measles deaths occur in developing countries, mostly in Africa and Asia. There is no specific treatment for measles, but the two-dose vaccine against it is about 97% effective in preventing severe illness and death. Okay, well, let's get back to a little bit more seasonal news. This from the American Heart Association. Winter holidays bring more heart attack deaths than any other time of year. Don't you love that great seasonal news? The joy of the winter holiday season is often marred for many, as research shows that more people die from heart attacks during the last week of December than at any other time of year. The American Heart Association, the world's leading voluntary organization focused on heart and brain health for all, says being aware of this annual phenomenon and taking a few important heart healthy steps may save lives. The holidays are busy, often stressful time for many of us. Routines are disrupted. We may tend to eat and drink more and exercise and relax less. We're getting too little sleep and experiencing too much stress. We also may not be listening to our bodies or paying attention to warning signs, thinking a trip to the doctor can wait until after the new year. While we don't know exactly why there are more deadly heart attacks during this time of year, it's important to be aware that all of these factors can be snowballing contributors to increasing the risk for a deadly cardiac event. Here's a couple tips. Celebrate in moderation. Eating healthfully during the holidays doesn't have to mean depriving yourself. There's still ways to eat smart. Look for small, healthy changes and swaps you can make so you can continue to feel your best while eating and drinking in moderation. And don't forget to watch your salt intake. Plan for peace on earth and goodwill towards yourself. Make time to take care of yourself during the busy holiday. Reduce stress from family interactions, strained finances, hectic schedules, and other stressors prevalent this time of year, including traveling. Keep moving. The American Heart Association recommends at least 150 minutes of physical activity per week, and this number usually drops during the hustle and bustle of the holidays. Get creative with ways to stay active, even if it's going for a family walk or another fun activity you can do with your loved ones. Stick to your meds. Busy holidays can cause you to skip medications, forgetting them when away from home or not getting refills in a timely manner. And be sure to keep tabs on your blood pressure numbers, for sure. And in more related seasonal news, this is from CNN, poor sleep can make you prickly. Here's what to do. Holiday stress, work problems, money concerns, family issues, the worries that can keep you up at night are infinite. Develop a sleep debt from those worries and you'll pay a price in your ability to think, plan, and manage your emotions. Sleep deprivation affects nearly half of American adults, study finds. Sleep debt, also called a sleep deficit, is the difference between the amount of sleep someone needs and the amount they actually get, said sleep specialist Dr. Raj Dasgupta, an associate professor of clinical medicine at the University of Southern California School of Medicine. Sleep affects our ability to think, react, remember, and solve problems. Symptoms of daytime fatigue include a lack of motivation to accomplish everyday tasks, a lack of productivity at work, memory problems, and a low interest in being social. There's another side effect as well. You may find yourself going ballistic over the slightest slight. Sleep loss is strongly associated with reduced empathy and emotional regulation, Dasgupta said, often resulting in miscommunication and retaliation during conflict. Mood regulation occurs in the frontal lobe of the brain, where thinking, problem solving, and memory consolidation also occur. The frontal lobe is the highest energy user in the brain and the first to go offline or malfunction when deprived of energy by a lack of sleep, said stress management expert Dr. Cynthia Ackrell, an editor for the Contentment magazine produced by the American Institute of Stress. Don't ruin your slumber during the holidays. Try these sleep expert tips. Without enough sleep, your brain functions less efficiently, affecting your coping skills, according to Ackrell. We don't have the bandwidth to recognize our choices, get creative, or just see that we can choose not to be irritated or irritating, she said. Irritability is one of the key signs of stress and poor sleep. Unfortunately, it doesn't take long for sleep to affect our emotional stability, Dasgupta said. Just one night of sleep loss impairs the ability to regulate emotions and the expression of them. Perhaps you are living with a sleep deficit and believe you are making it through the day with no real impact. Experts, however, beg to differ. Researchers found many people have little idea how much poor sleep has affected their mood and coping skills, says Dr. Banu Prakash Kola, a sleep medicine specialist in the Center for Sleep Medicine at the Mayo Clinic. In experimental studies where they have partially sleep-deprived subjects, the subjective awareness of sleepiness and deterioration tends to plateau after a little while, but objective sleepiness and other performance-related measures continue to deteriorate, Kola said. Therefore, don't assume that if you feel fine that you are fine, said sleep specialist Kristen Knutson, an associate professor of neurology and preventive medicine at Northwestern University School of Medicine. There is no exact formula, but the longer you have been depriving yourself of sleep, the longer it will take to recover, Knutson said. If you deprive yourself of sleep for a week or more, it'll take more than a day or two to fully compensate. To recover all of your cognition and mood regulation, however, you may need more than 2 days of sleep recovery. What to do? First, don't reach for a sleeping aid to fix the problem, Desgupta said. Sleep medications are seldom the solution for chronically poor sleeping and impaired daytime functioning, he said. Long-term use of certain sleeping aids can lead to dependency, making users unable to sleep without pills, and there are withdrawal effects that impair cognition even after the drugs have been stopped. Instead, start with making sure that you don't have an underlying illness or are taking a medication that might affect your ability to sleep. In addition to primary sleep disorders such as obstructive sleep apnea and insomnia, there are many other issues that can cause daytime fatigue, such as diabetes, heart disease, and chronic pain issues, Desgupta said. Then prioritize sleep. Make it as important as eating, exercising, showering, and all the other things you do on a daily basis. Consider sleep to be a pillar of health, Kola said. Make sure your bedroom environment is quiet, dark, and comfortable. If you are consistently sleeping poorly and this is impacting your daytime functioning, consider speaking to a sleep specialist. The American Academy of Sleep Medicine advises that if you're an adult between the ages of 18 and 60, you're supposed to get 7 or more hours of sleep each night. But according to the CDC, a third of U.S. adults get fewer than 7 hours of sleep per night. We should set healthy sleep goals, including trying to go to bed at the same time most nights and aiming for 7 to 8 hours of sleep, Knutson said. Also, we should allow ourselves a transition period to unwind and relax between active wake and sleep. When it comes to all those worries, stress management expert Ackrell has some tips for coping. Don't leave your mind to ruminate on something while you sleep. Close the day by capturing what you need to remember in a list. Write down worries so you can dump them out before bed. Recognize when you are layering worries and don't beat up yourself, she said. Don't worry about not sleeping or feeling worried. Instead, consider some sort of active relaxation practice, such as breath work, progressive relaxation, or meditation. Practice positivity, but not the toxic version that is really denial, she added. Instead, find some way to continually bring your attention to what is working, what or who really matters to you, what habits support your feeling positive and grounded, and how to leverage your unique strengths to handle the pressures of life. There are tons of apps to help, Ackrell said. And you are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, next up, a story about another pillar of health, diet, this from NBC News. Americans are eating more whole grains, but are still confused by the food labels. It's not unusual to see packages of bread, crackers, cereals, or pasta with a stamp on the front touting in large letters that they're whole grain. In reality, they may not have much real whole grain in them, a new study suggests. An analysis of 2 decades of data on Americans' diets revealed that people are increasingly choosing whole grain foods, but we're still not eating enough in our daily diets. Tufts University researchers reported in a study published recently in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. At least half of the grains consumed daily should be whole grains, according to USDA's recommendations. Part of the problem is people can't always tell which foods contain a healthier amount of whole grains. That's likely because between the FDA, the food industry, and research groups and health associations, there are differing definitions of what constitutes a whole grain product, the Tufts researchers noted. The label on a food item just tells consumers that, by the Whole Grain Council's definition, each serving has at least 8 grams of whole grains, said study co-author Dr. Fang Zhang, interim chair at the Division of Nutritional Epidemiology and Data Science at the School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University. The Whole Grain Council is an industry-sponsored group that stamps labels on food packaging. However, the 8 grams might be only a small percentage of the whole serving, and the product might also have a lot of added sugar, Zhang said. For the FDA to label a food whole grain, 51% of the total weight must be whole grain. The research group Cereals and Grains Association requires 8 grams of whole grain for every 30 grams of a food item, and the American Heart Association calculates the ratio of carbohydrates to fiber in defining a whole grain food. Consumers need to be careful when they go shopping for whole grain foods. They need to look at the back of the package to check the nutrition facts and determine whether whole grains are at the top of the ingredient list. What's important is the percentage of the total grain in a food that is actually whole grain, Zhang said. The 2015 to 2020 Dietary Guidelines for Americans identifies whole grain foods as those containing 50% or more by weight of the grain or flour containing component as whole grain ingredients. The only way to know whether a product really is whole grain is to look at the ingredient list. And may whole grains be number one. And next up from the Hill, few Americans are aware of cancer risk posed by alcohol, says study. A low number of Americans are aware of the myriad cancer risks posed by alcohol consumption. Just over 30% know liquor can increase the risk of certain cancers, while 25% said the same about beer and only 20% about wine, according to a new study from the American Association of Cancer Research. More Americans believe wine decreases cancer risk compared with beer and liquor, and over half of those surveys did not know how the beverages affected cancer risk. Data were gleaned from a nationally represented survey of over 3,000 U.S. adults carried out in 2020. Findings were consistent regardless of whether respondents drank or not. All types of alcoholic beverages, including wine, increase cancer risk, said lead author William Klein, associate director of the National Cancer Institute's Behavioral Research Program. Any beverage containing ethanol, including wine, beer, and liquor, increases the risk of cancer. Alcohol use accounts for 6% of all cancer cases in the United States and 4% of all cancer deaths, according to the American Cancer Society. Studies have shown a link between alcohol intake and cancers of the mouth, throat, voice box, esophagus, liver, colon and rectum, and breast. The risks are especially elevated for breast cancer. Compared with women who don't drink, those who consume 3 alcoholic beverages a week are 15% more likely to develop breast cancer, while that risk increases by 10% for each additional drink women regularly consume each day. Responses also varied by age, as adults over the age of 60 demonstrated lower awareness of alcohol as a risk factor for cancer than those between the ages of 18 and 39. Recent data show alcohol and drug-related deaths have spiked among Americans aged 65 and older, with alcohol-induced death rates increasing by 18% from 2020 to 2021. The study's findings underscore the need to develop interventions for educating the public about the cancer risks of alcohol use, particularly in the prevailing context of a national dialogue about the purported heart health benefits of wine, which in fact aren't true. Interventions could include mass media campaigns, tailored messaging, cancer warning labels, and increased communication between patients and providers, researchers said. And in more alcohol-related news, this is a really interesting study that points out specifically how punishment in public health does not work very well. This from Medical Express. Laws allowing insurers to deny alcohol-related claims do not deter drinking, study suggests. State laws designed to prevent dangerous drinking behaviors do not appear to have that effect, according to a study published in Alcoholism, Clinical and Experimental Research. Alcohol exclusion laws allow insurance companies to deny payment for injuries caused by alcohol consumption and were adopted more than 70 years ago to prevent problem drinking and related insurance costs. But a rigorous analysis of drinking behaviors found no evidence that repealing these laws increases alcohol consumption or binge drinking. Previous reports have found these laws to be a barrier to screening and treatment for alcohol issues, resulting in billions of dollars in added healthcare costs. Alcohol exclusion laws began to be adopted by states following the recommendation in 1947 of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, maybe that's not who we should be listening to, which reasoned that people would not engage in problem drinking if they knew that insurance would not cover claims for physical injuries caused by alcohol consumption. In 2001, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners reversed its position and recommended the repeal of these laws, recognizing alcohol dependency as an illness requiring treatment. Alcohol exclusion laws have been repealed in some states, but remain in effect in at least 23 states. So yeah, you probably shouldn't ask the people who have the most financial gain from a particular action to be making the recommendations. Need to take care to get rid of those conflicts of interest. And again, public health works with a non-judgmental, non-punishing approach in the long run. And in more drug news, this from the San Diego Union-Tribune, DEA says 6 out of 10 fake prescription pills analyzed contain potentially deadly dose of fentanyl. The DEA said 6 out of 10 fake prescription pills it tested contained a potentially lethal dose of fentanyl, up from 4 out of 10 discovered in testing in 2021. It was unclear how many pills underwent analysis. Federal officials say counterfeit pills, which often look like legitimate prescription medicines, including OxyContin, Percocet, and Xanax, are being mass-produced by the Sinaloa cartel and the Jalisco cartel in Mexico. Precursors imported from China and other drugs are pressed into pills, powder, or mixed into other drugs. Fentanyl is a highly addictive synthetic opioid that is 50 times more potent than heroin and 100 times more potent than morphine. According to the CDC, over 107,000 Americans died of fatal drug overdoses in 2021, with over 71,000 of those deaths involving synthetic opioids, primarily fentanyl. Because a teeny amount of fentanyl can lead to a fatal overdose, officials have warned users that fake prescription drugs can be laced with fentanyl, and one pill can kill. And next up, a very interesting story. I really pondered what I would call the social meaning of different morbidity and mortality. And this study gets an interesting perspective on how different injuries have different effects. This from Medical Express. Firearm injuries in kids leave lasting mental scars, study finds. Children and teens who survive a firearm injury have a high rate of developing new mental health diagnoses in the year afterward, even compared with kids who suffered injuries in a motor vehicle crash, a new study shows. In all, 35% of firearm-injured kids received a new mental health diagnosis in a year after incident, compared with 26% of those hurt in crashes. Most of these new diagnoses were related to substance misuse problems with drugs or alcohol, or stress-related conditions such as post-traumatic stress disorder, both of which were twice as likely to be diagnosed in young firearm injury survivors than in their peers who had been in vehicles that crashed. The study helped shed light on the impact of firearm injuries among young people who survived them. In 2020, firearms overtook motor vehicle crashes as the number one cause of death for Americans age 1 to 19. But the lack of research funding for studies of firearm injuries and their aftermath have meant an information gap for teams caring for an estimated 20,000 young people who survive firearm injuries every year. Well, next up, we have a healthcare story. This from Medical Express. Having a high health insurance deductible leads women to skip testing after abnormal mammograms. This may fit in the well duh category. One in five women is likely to forego additional testing after an abnormal finding on a screening mammogram if there's a deductible, according to a new study presented at the annual meeting of the Radiological Society of North America. The Affordable Care Act removed out-of-pocket costs for screening mammograms under most health plans to encourage women to partake in this important preventative health care measure, said the study's lead author, Michael Nago, radiology resident in Boston Medical Center. However, the screening mammogram is only the first step to detect breast cancer. If the radiologist detects an abnormal finding on the screening image, then additional images and a biopsy are needed to determine if the patient has cancer. The Affordable Care Act does not mandate insurance to cover the costs of these additional services. The results show that a deductible payment for follow-up breast imaging after an abnormal finding on screening mammography discourages 21% of women from returning for additional evaluation and appears to lead 18% of women to skip the initial free screening altogether, Dr. Nago said. Identifying socioeconomic barriers to healthcare is critical in addressing existing disparities and ensuring better outcomes for vulnerable patient populations. The researchers hope that these findings will be useful in efforts to remove financial barriers to care. So this is, you know, on top of hundreds of studies that have documented this type of thing. And what's interesting here is they asked women if they know ahead of time that they don't cover a follow-up. The thing is free, but if you need a follow-up, that it isn't. Almost as many people, 18% versus 21%, who would not return for an additional evaluation. They just don't go down that path. And this is the problem. If you're financially limited and you're going to enter down a path that you can't afford, you know, why even take the first step if you're just going to find seven steps down the line that you're not going to be able to proceed with what you need healthcare-wise?
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Okay, well, let's conclude my regular health reporting in this episode with some good, interesting, exciting news from another Ohio city, Cleveland. This from the Cleveland Plain Dealer. How Cleveland will expand air monitoring in poor neighborhoods disproportionately burdened by pollution. The Cleveland Department of Public Health and a host of community partners plan to improve air quality monitoring in disadvantaged areas of the city and devise strategies for reducing their exposure to hazardous pollution. An expanded network of monitors will focus on fine particulates and ground-level ozone that can exacerbate asthma, a disease that inflames the airway and makes it harder to breathe. Roughly 8 to 10% of children have asthma nationally, said Christine Yoka, chief of air pollution outreach at the Department of Health. But for areas of Cleveland, those rates approach 24%. The U.S. EPA has awarded the health department a $500,000 grant to allow for the purchase of mobile air monitoring unit that will measure the presence of fine and coarse particulates as well as ground-level ozone, according to Brian Sokolowski, chief of monitoring at the Cleveland Department of Public Health. The Cleveland area meets federal standards for all criteria pollutants except for ground-level ozone, which could be a major irritant for asthma sufferers, Sokolowski said. Ground-level ozone is created when nitrogen oxide, created by fossil fuel combustion, and volatile organic compounds present in chemical vapors, mix in the atmosphere, and are exposed to the ultraviolet rays of the sun. It takes about 3 hours for the ground-level ozone to form, and when it does, it can be considerably downwind from where the base components were emitted. This could explain why the highest readings in the region for ground-level ozone are registered in Eastlake, even though the emissions that create the ground-level ozone may come from other places, such as the industrial flats and heavily congested highways. It's not a source-specific pollutant, he said. Researchers expect the data to help pinpoint air quality hotspots in Cleveland and provide the impetus for setting policies and strategies to reduce the hazards. The data could also guide the health department in deciding if a factory should be inspected for compliance with its emissions permit. The data obtained by the new monitors will be included on a public dashboard that can be accessed to determine real-time air quality in specific neighborhoods. The information can also help identify specific reasons for bad air, such as proximity to factories or idling traffic, and to suggest ways to mitigate the problems. Having precise measurement should also help make the case for taking action. People may be pretty certain that a problem exists, but sometimes it does take hard data to make change. There are also researchers who want to use the air quality data to conduct studies on patients to determine how environmental exposure may be affecting the long-term progression of their cardiovascular and respiratory ailments. It could all have the makings of one of the country's, if not the world's, most comprehensive environmental monitoring systems, he said, which is pretty exciting. Way to go, Cleveland. Okay, well, now we've arrived at the final segment, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give you the link at the end of the list. This week, 19 bonus articles. First up, going way back in time, which of course affects the past, affects the present. Uranium Mill's legacy of pollution is still a toxic threat across dozens of sites. There were about 50 of his uranium milling sites that are polluting dozens and dozens of communities to this day. Still a problem. Bonus article number two, Endgame, how the visionary hospice movement became a for-profit hustle. The for-profit healthcare knows no end and is a cancer that takes over even visionary movements. Article 3, stop hospital consolidations to lower healthcare prices for all Americans. So 90% of metropolitan areas in the United States are rated as having high concentration of markets, basically controlled by one entity. Not good for our health. Community health. Article 4, common treatments for knee osteoarthritis may be harmful. Steroids and NSAIDs reduce pain, but not disease course. So you may get pain relief, but it may actually even accelerate the deterioration for a variety of reasons. So another, just remember, there's always side effects for treatments. So include that in your calculation about what kind of treatments you're going to take. Article 5, Abortion advocates aim to outflank lawmakers using 2024 ballot measures. So this is a good opportunity for a number of states to turn anti-abortion states into abortion access states. Article 6, though, anti-abortion forces push local bans in states with legal access. So the anti-abortion forces are going to individual cities in states that have legal abortion access and are trying to prevent, like, for instance, clinics being set up there or just make it illegal, even without that on the horizon. Just another battle. The one good thing I would say is, you know, if we're going to devolve abortion rights down from the federal to the state and then the cities, why don't we just go all the way and let each individual woman make the choice themselves? Another abortion story, Article 7. Without abortion, doctors in Texas are forced to witness horrible outcomes. So this was completely expected, but now that we've had enough time where these ultra bans have happened of abortion, we're seeing really bad outcomes, often in people who aren't necessarily seeking abortion, but pregnancy can be a dangerous situation. And if you have strict abortion laws, it may prevent the normal health care you would get to avoid terrible outcomes. And 8, she wanted an abortion. A judge said she wasn't mature enough to decide. So another conundrum we're in here. We're telling women that they may have to have a child, but then we're on one hand, and then the other hand, we're telling they're not mature enough to decide whether they have an abortion or not. Yikes. Another one on the abortion activism front, Article 9. The role reversal should activate doctor and nurse activism. So this is written by a healthcare worker saying that the time has come to become an activist if you're a doctor or nurse regarding reproductive rights. And a somewhat related story, Article 10, due to masculine dominance, gynecological science focuses on reproduction rather than women's health. Yep, masculine-dominated gynecological science has left women's health in the wake of a focus on reproduction. Need to balance that out. Article 11, paid sick days are necessary for parents and children to withstand the triple-demic. So I've been talking about the viral soup we've been in, you know, this flu season. Of course, it's been true the whole COVID-19 pandemic. And of course, we had the rail strike that was averted by Congress forcing the rail workers to accept an agreement that they did not want, which basically was asking for some sick days. You got people that are making $85,000 a year who don't have any sick days in a career that's very dangerous. And they really put their lives on the line during the COVID-19 pandemic and are not being rewarded for it. So this is a good, just from a doctor who is actually dealing with patients who you give them recommendations for, like, staying home or keeping your kid home, and people can't do it, but they don't have any paid sick days. So this is the conundrum of living in a capitalist society where money and work is more valued than people and their families and their communities. Okay, Article 12. There's no such thing as a good cold. Immunity debt helps explain this year's eye-popping cold and flu season, but it is often dangerously misinterpreted. So this is a good long kind of think piece offering perspective. Some of the anti-vaxxers, you know, say that, well, because you're not, you know, being exposed to all these viruses, that somehow it ends up being worse. But of course, the whole idea is to avoid diseases in the first place, not to get them in order to avoid them. But of course, getting infected does offer some infection down the line, but the best way to get that is by getting immunizations so you can get the immune response without the disease. Article 13, Twitter stops enforcing COVID-19 misinformation policy. So the mess that is now Twitter, more wide open and not a friendly place to be regarding COVID-19 misinformation. Article 14, the future of monkeypox. As case numbers fall, the outbreak could become entrenched. So numbers, thankfully, have fallen a lot, but like a lot of other largely sexually transmitted diseases, as it's played out in this current outbreak in the U.S., a common story in public health, when the epidemic seems to end, the endemic continues. Article 15, Trank is leaving drug users with horrific wounds, and spreading use leaves other communities bracing for the same. So Trank is this veterinary tranquilizer that's being added to a lot of drugs. And unfortunately, one of the effects it has is creating these terrible open wounds. Yikes. So as this spreads across the country, we're bracing for that. Article 16, schools, sheriffs, and syringes. State plans vary for spending $26 billion in opioid settlement funds. So one of these huge opioid settlement funds, there's a fight at local levels between schools and communities and sheriffs. Basically, once again, a battle between a law enforcement approach versus a public health approach. May the schools and communities win, and the families that are affected with a public health approach. Article 17. Why falling asleep with the lights on is bad for your health. So I did a sleep hygiene story. This is a good follow-up to get in some of the nitty-gritty of why falling asleep with lights is bad for your health. Article 18, a dangerous chilling effect in gender-affirming care. Gender-affirming facilities must continue offering information and resources despite threats. So places that offer gender-affirming care are actually pulling down information from the web because they're being attacked and threatened, and it's chilling the availability of those seeking that care to even find where to get good care and get good information. And last but not least, bonus article number 19, the mental health industry speaks volumes about our capitalistic society's priorities. This is a good piece just outlining the fact that in our capitalist society, we tend to center the idea of mental illness as something that's between our ears, when in fact, a lot of it is a response to a sick society. And if we took care of the problems in the sick society, we'd find that mysteriously, these mental health problems would recede. So there's a lot of information about the fact that mental health doesn't really have a discernible biological basis. In other words, some chemical imbalance, all that. There's not a good basis for that. And that actually an understanding of the social conditions resulting in mental health problems is much more powerful and is a driver for social change. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.